ladies and gentlemen. I feel very honoured to be here, I must admit. It seems a long way, a 10-hour flight, but I think I've enjoyed it, and I hope we're going to learn something together. Right, the importance then of phosphorus. It's true to say, I think, that life as we know it on planet Earth would not exist without phosphorus. Phosphorus plays a vital role, and it's non-substitutable in the functioning of every living cell. And approximately 90% of all mined phosphate rock is processed for use in food production, and to lengthen the lifespan of this global resource, it must be used efficiently. And on the bottom there is some plots from England with sugar beet, and on the right there, some maize from Brazil. So why is it important? And it's because the supply of high quality rock, and the picture there is right, and I'm not quite sure that Steve would agree with me from what he said earlier on this morning, that the supply of very high quality rock, which is easily accessible, is probably limited. But as Steve has pointed out, there are reserves which are going to last for some hundreds of years. But the reason why we must use it efficiently is not only to lengthen the life of the reserves, but because if it's not used efficiently and it gets transferred from soils to water, then we have problems of eutrophication. But there is a problem with applying phosphate, as with any other input, has a cost implication. And so if we can use it more efficiently, there is a benefit to the farmer in the amount of money that he has to put into his systems. So what we have come up with, I think, is what must be the aim in the future. It must be to first build up the plant available phosphorus to a satisfactory level to maintain, and then to maintain this level in the soil. Exceeding the level which is sufficient for crop production is an unnecessary cost to the farmer. And if, as I say, if over-enriched soil gets transported into watercourses, then we have problems with eutrophication. But what then is the satisfactory level? Well, Keith and I have spent a few years now trying to put together his knowledge and information on the behaviour of phosphorus in soil, to with the data which we've had from some very long-term experiments at Rothamsted. Because these experiments were saying to us that essentially that old mantra that if you apply phosphorus to a soil and it's not used by a crop, it becomes irreversibly fixed in soil and will never become available again. A marvellous story, if I'm going to be cynical, a marvellous story for the fertiliser industry, because it simply meant that you put it on this year, you had to put it on next and next and next and next, and you've gone forever. I think what the long-term experiment showed us that this is not true, that we can apply phosphorus to soil and it will come back in time. So what we've come up with is this diagram of looking at soil phosphorus, inorganic phosphorus in soil, which is available to plants existing in four pools. In the first pool, we've got the soil solution phosphorus, where it is immediately available for uptake by crops, but where the amount is very small. We've got then a readily available, readily accessible pool, and then two other pools where the phosphorus gets more and more tightly held. I'm not interested at all in the amount of phosphorus which is in these first two pools. It's there, and we're not going to try to define it accurately in terms of only one extractant method. You use Bray here and Malik in the States. All the data I will show you in a minute or two is all done by Olson. It doesn't matter what method we use, provided that the method we use accurately characterizes a soil in relation to the crop response, either to applied phosphorus or to the soil phosphorus. So we're not at all interested, as I say, in what is there other than the amount. The methodology we use is independent, provided we have chosen a method which accurately classifies the soil. Let's look at just a few data. People do say, What we've shown there, of course, is that between each of these four pools, there is reversible transfer of phosphorus. And of course, originally, as we say, when we come to look at the fixation of phosphorus in soil, the assumption has been that it has always moved only from left to right in that figure. It goes from the soil solution into strongly bonded, highly unavailable phosphorus in the soil. And I said, what was happening in the long-term experiments at Rothamsted was showing that that was not true, that it would go in reverse. And is the reversible transfer of phosphorus? Well, this is some very recent data. We've published a lot of other data from other long-term experiments. But let me just look in this data set here on the positive peat balance between 1965 and 1967. We were adding three different amounts of phosphorus. We had soils with initial levels of P here, which small. The increase in the in Olsen P in milligrams per kilogram was larger when we get into the larger method, the larger amounts applied. And we see the change in, we can calculate these changes in Olsen P in terms of kilograms per hectare because we know accurately the soil weights in these long-term experiments. We can show then that the we had a P offtake, so we come back to the method that Paul was talking about, which is P balance. The P balance was highly positive for all three treatments, but only a small proportion of that P balance remained as an increase in the Olsen P in soil. So we're saying it has moved from pools 1 and 2 into pool 3. And then on the same plots, from 1969 to 1983-84, we start off with these high levels of P. We're applying no more phosphorus so that the Olsen P's have gone down. We can convert those to kilograms per hectare. We know what the P offtake has been. And what we find, of course, now is that only a small proportion of the change in Olsen P is actually affected by the change in the P balance. And when, interestingly enough, the lower the Olsen P in the soil to begin with, the smaller the amount of phosphorus uptake can be accounted for by that phosphorus that has been taken up. And so we are getting a lot of phosphorus coming back from these old pools. And I think it just highlights a comment that Paul made a few minutes ago, and that is that traditionally, in many parts of the developed countries, we have over years built up large amounts of phosphorus in these soils because of the methodologies which we used, and now we're being able to get that phosphorus back in time. I think, too, that there is some concern about, well, will we ever get it back? As I say, the original concept is going to be fixed forever and ever and ever. But we have a long-term experiment on the Rothamsted called the Exhaustion Land Site. It started in 1856. The experiment is still going today. Between 1856 and 1901, phosphorus was applied to those plots in both fertilizer and farmyard manure. From 1901 to the current day, on a number of these plots, we have applied no more phosphorus. And yet we have monitored throughout the whole of this period the phosphorus offtake in the crops which has been harvested. And what we see then is that we have this plot here with no P since 1856, with P applied from 1856 to 1901, this middle plot here, no P applied, the next one with P applied. And for various periods, we know what the P offtake has been. And we find that there has been, in this first period from 1902 to 1940, a total offtake of about 130 kilograms of P, an annual offtake of about 3. And then where we have put on phosphorus, we've had a larger offtake, obviously, because we have been taking off a bigger crop, but the annual offtake has been somewhat larger, at about 6 kilograms of P, and the annual difference was nearly 2.6, 2.7 kilograms. So we're getting that, in that first period, we're getting back some of that residue which we'd accumulated. That was a period when we were putting no nitrogen on and the yields were small, and then we go to a period from 1976 to 1991 where we're growing spring barley with nitrogen, and we find that actually now our annual offtake has gone up a little bit. It's gone up a little bit from the residues because we're getting bigger crops, and therefore we're getting a bigger annual difference. And so it goes on through all of these four periods. And what we're seeing is that essentially we have recovered a lot of native phosphorus from the soil. We're getting it back at something like about 4 kilograms per hectare per year. This is obviously coming from soil mineral reserves. But where we have put that phosphorus on from 1856 and no more since then, where we put phosphorus on up till 1901 and no more since then, we are still recovering that phosphorus. And of the total phosphorus that was in those soils, we have now got back over just nearly 80% of the accumulated total P. So what is then the practical outcome if we accept this concept of being four pools of inorganic phosphorus plant available in soils? It is that how much phosphorus should there be in pools 1 and 2, which is readily available for plant uptake? And critically, we can say that if we've got plot, theoretically we can plot yield against readily available phosphorus. And we can say we will come to a critical level where we get the yield is 98% of the asymptotic yield. And here are some examples from experiments at Rothamsted. This is all small plot work, and I've only got the pictures there to emphasize the fact that it is small plot work. You've got to be careful, you've got to do it reasonably well. But what we see is in each case that we do reach a critical value which is independent of yield. Critical level is independent of yield, and it changes there for sugar from sugar beet, for spring barley. A difference yield there of from 2 to nearly 7 tonnes per hectare, driven by climatic factors, rainfall in those years, driven there by climatic factors, here at the bottom with winter wheat, driven by nitrogen application. Now we've looked at some of this data in a little bit more detail, and what we find that we have attempted to take 15 years worth of data here for winter wheat, where we have plotted winter wheat yields and come to the maximum yield and the Olsen P associated with 98% of the maximum yield. And you see that it varies straight away. And everyone says, well, there is clearly no unique critical value. And yes, we would agree. There is no unique critical value which is going to stand from year on year on year. And that was with winter wheat, and in the same experiment we had spring barley, and we find exactly the same data set. Let me just go back to that spring winter wheat one again. And what we find is that we do have an unlimited number of plots where we have high levels of Olsen P are required to achieve 98% of the maximum yield. And why do we get these variations? It's pretty obvious, I think, that the vertical variation from year between years is due to the growing season in those years. How much rain did we get? How well did we suppress weeds and pests and diseases? We're pretty good, I think, now at weed control and pest and disease control, but you can't control the weather, and weather is a great controller of yield. But then, why then do we get a spread of values in the Olsen P? Why does it fall into various categories? And I have a strong belief that this is because of soil conditions. That we are not able to reproduce a good seed bed year on year on year. We do have things which we do badly in terms of soil structure. And if I have one belief at all, it is the future lies with our ability to produce soils with a good soil structure. And that is crucial to the ability of roots to go through the soil mass and acquire the nutrients which they require. So then, as I say, it's annual weather which makes the change in terms of rainfall and sunshine and its soil conditions. And this is some data which I want to try to show in relation to this fact that soil structure is very important and that soil organic matter plays an important role in soil structure. This was from an experiment where we grew spring barley, potatoes and sugar beet in 2 years for each of them, on soils which we had managed to achieve different levels of organic matter. Actually, this is all on one site, so we're not looking at aggregated data. It took us 12 years to acquire or to build up these plots with the different levels of organic matter. And my heart goes out these days to young researchers who don't get the opportunity to go into long-term funding. I'm not quite sure how many people these days would support a 12-year experiment where you're still building up to get your treatments, which eventually you're going to have the effort of testing what you're trying to define. As I say, my heart goes out to those young people. We were fortunate that we did have a whole, if you like, administrative system that said future does lie with agriculture way back in the 1950s and 1960s, remembering that people had gotten hungry during the war. And I'm afraid we're running out of this ability, in my view, to accept that agriculture is a sustainable industry and we want to know what makes it sustainable. So in these experiments, you can see that at the different levels of organic matter for all three crops, we did in fact get approximately the same maximum yield. But the Olsen P associated with that maximum yield was vastly different. Which is more, I accept that it's very difficult to build up the organic matter in soil, and it would be foolish to say it was easy. But if we look to our using of phosphorus efficiently, then we've got to relate it to our ability to maintain a good soil structure, which therefore the plant can find. And you can see that essentially the percent variance accounted for is much larger on soils, small organic matter. And just to go back to these two previous curves. With the percent variance accounted for in all of these experiments when we plotted yield against Olsen P was between 70 and 90%. So essentially Olsen P was really the only factor that was controlling yield in terms of nutrient supply. We come then to something I think which Paul has already alluded to, that there are different methods for assessing P use efficiency, and we've got the direct method where we label the fertilizer with P32, expensive. It usually only lasts for 1 year. You can only do it for 1 year. We have the difference method, which we've used up to now, where we express yield or P uptake when fertilizer P is applied relative to that when none is applied. And that has been the traditional method. But in looking at the data that we had, Keith and I came to the conclusion that there is another way of doing it, which is the balance method. And what is the rationale for that? Well, as Paul showed in some of his data, the crop actually only takes up somewhere between 10 and 25% of the phosphorus which is applied directly as fertilizer. The remaining of phosphorus has got to come from the soil reserves. It is going to come from the soil reserves, and we're not going to decrease soil fertility. We've got to put that phosphorus back. And therefore, to me, it is highly a part of phosphorus use efficiency to say it's what has gone into the crop, and it's what has gone back into soil reserves to maintain that soil in a fertile condition to grow crops for feed and food. So that is our rationale for the balanced method. And does it work? Well, again, we have got the Broadbalk experiment at Rothamsted, started in 1843, winter wheat grown each year, and we can express the recovery of the phosphorus which is applied with three different rates of nitrogen by the difference method, and it never comes much better than 40%. But when we use the balanced method, we're up to 80%. Because we're putting back into soil reserves that which is being taken up by the crop. And then some recent experiments, there's a fair bit of data, I'm afraid, on this slide, but it has been our attempt to look at this in more detail. And we had a first attempt in the 1970s on our site at Saxmundham, sandy clay loam soil. We had a range of Olsen P values which we had built up. Again, it took us 6 or 7 years to build up that range of phosphorus values. Again, then we come into a testing phase. We know what the total phosphorus was applied. We decided that this was an application intended to last for 2 years, 157 kilograms of pea. This was our total offtake because we were getting a variation in yield. The phosphorus balance was very large. It became smaller and smaller. Interestingly, as you will see, can see when you're on a very, again, when you get on a soil which is very low in Olson pea to begin with, the change in Olson pea, for a comparable offtake, is still very small. Phosphorus is coming back from this reserve which we've built up in pools three, particularly in pool three. But because our offtake is small relative to the amount applied, then phosphorus use efficiency was quite small in that group of years. Then we tried to get better at it on that exhaustion land site which I showed you just now between 2005 and 2008. Again, we had a very large range of Olson peas. And what you'll see here, I'm able to give here the yield which we got. And quite clearly, at this level of Olson pea, the two top levels of Olson pea, we're at the maximum yield. So we're at the critical level of soil pea for winter wheat on that soil. And then we were, again, we were putting back the phosphorus which was applied. Now, you can imagine, I'm sure, that on small plots, logistically, to have the crop analysed, work out how much pea you've got to put back, and do it on an annual basis when you're growing winter wheat and you harvest in August and you're going to replant in September, it's logistically almost impossible. And so we decided that we would make the opportunity to apply the same amount of pea to all of the plots as a balancing dressing. So we put on 80 kilograms of pea per hectare per year, and then we look at the amount of phosphorus removed, which of course goes up as the yield goes up, and as we get to the critical level of soil phosphorus, the amount of phosphorus which is taken up is very close to the amount which was applied. The balance is small, the positive balance is small, and we come back to the effect that if we can, we've got a balance efficiency expressed by the balance method, which is nearly 100%. So what I think we're trying to say at the moment then is that we should adopt a thought process which says there are four pools of plant available inorganic phosphorus, that phosphorus can move between these four pools, that we would want to know how much phosphorus there is in the readily plant available pool, which is pools one and two, the soil solution, and that which is readily extractable. It doesn't matter what method of extraction we use, provided that it characterizes the soil accurately, provided that we have once got the soil to the critical value, so that we're at the maximum value for that particular Olson pea level. In other words, this is our critical value, those are our maximum yields. Then if we put back the phosphorus which we take off in the crop which we have grown, then we will use our annual application of phosphorus with maximum efficiency, and hopefully therefore minimize the risk that there might be of phosphorus loss to transport to surface water. And we will maximise the opportunity for the farmer to make the maximum yield out of the costs of his inputs. Thank you, Chairman. And just perhaps one very final comment. I'd just like to go back, if I may, with your permission. In 1909, A.D. Hall, who was then director of Rothamsted, wrote, "The future too lies with intensive farming, where we are today. Every year the ratio of the cultivable land to the population of the world shrinks. Every year science puts new resources and fresh resources into the hands of the farmer. Intensive farming implies the use of more fertilizers. Still more, it implies, or should imply, and don't forget he was talking over 100 years ago, implies or should imply skill and knowledge in using them." Well, gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen, we're still learning, but learn we must. Thank you.